My name is Dustin Kelly, but everybody calls me DJ. I'm prior Army, serving as both a Ford Observer and a military police officer. I've spent the last 14 and a half years as a police officer and detective in a large metropolitan police department. Two things that I've learned throughout my career. One, everybody has a story to tell. And two, the best stories are true. This is the DTD Podcast. This week in the studio. At the age of 17, my guest embarked on an unconventional journey by enlisting in the Army as an all-source intel analyst. After high school, he completed his education, earned a bachelor's degree in strategic studies and defense analysis, and later would complete a master's in strategic studies. In 2018, he deployed to Djibouti, where he served with the 404th Civil Affairs Battalion. Subsequently, my guest ventured to Afghanistan and later to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. These diverse deployments broadened his horizons and honed his skills. His transition to the Threat Screening Center and later to a role supporting the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency and the FBI's National Joint Terrorism Task Force was marked by academic accomplishments, including that completion of his master's degree. In 2022, the allure of overseas service beckoned once more, leading him to Qatar to support Special Operations Command. Now he eagerly awaits his next assignment, where he will continue to serve the Department of Defense in Northern Virginia. Beneath the surface of his professional journey lies a deep-rooted family tradition of military service and an abiding passion for literature, which eventually culminated in the writing and self-publishing of numerous books beginning in 2021 and continuing to this day. Please welcome into the studio, Zach James. In 3, 2, 1, and we're live. Welcome back in. Zach, I'm so glad you joined me. I've been reading your books. You have a pretty crazy career in how you went about it. You were in the Army, but then you started contracting. And then you kind of got the bug on contracting, but I want to go back and talk about before even your military career. You have a long history in your family of military service. So can we talk about what drove you to kind of take that step and then kind of live out this dream of not only military, but contracting work?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, thank you for having me out here. Love the show. Really happy to be here and get a chance to finally sit down and talk with you. Basically, the short answer is my dad. My dad was in the military. He was in a couple different branches, but he was in the Navy and the Army, from what I remember when I was growing up. He had a short stint in the Air Force too, but I don't remember that one. And yeah, just growing up him, you know, watching all the war movies with him, seeing him when he would go off to drill or JROTC or NCTC, and then when he'd come back, it was, you know, that just locked me in hook, line, and sinker.
Now, was there anyone else in your family, grandfathers, anything like that, where there was military service that either they did or didn't talk to you about it, but you knew that it was there? Because, like, with my grandparents and stuff, I knew that they served. I knew the uncles served. But back in that time, really, they didn't talk about that kind of stuff. So did you have further down the line other than your father?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So both of my grandparents, or both my grandfathers served. My grandfather, who is my dad's biological father, he served as a tanker in the Army during Vietnam, but he wasn't in Vietnam. He was in Germany at the time. And then my grandfather, who is my dad's stepfather, had been a Marine. He was some kind of financial clerk. And he was in that time between Vietnam and Korea. And they were both very, very honest and, you know, and just open about what they did, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, you talk to a Vietnam vet and they were some kind of sniper, tunnel rat, MACV, SOG, cool guy. And I was very lucky to have my grandfathers who, you know, yeah, they served and they served honorably, but they did their jobs. They weren't, you know, they weren't cream of the crop, tip of the spear. They were very honest with me about their service. And my family's military service goes back even further. I had several great grandfathers who served. They actually were off the boat. came to the US and then joined the military because they saw it as a service to the country. And then I think it was about 19 years old, maybe 20, and we actually found out that I had a couple of ancestors who served in the Italian Alpini, the mountain troops, back in the late 19th century. And then to go way further back, my grandfather actually told me recently that some historical documents were found that dates our family all the way back to the 10th century Crusades. So I, it's kind of cliche, but I guess I would say it's in my blood.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up the point of when people talk about their career, that they tend to make things up. Some people tend to make things up, and that you had grandparents that just told you, like, yeah, I was in the military, but this is what I did. Do you think that had any kind of effect on how you approached your military career? Not really boisterous or anything about it, because you did 8 years, but then you turned right around and did contracting. So do you think that kind of truthfulness helped you out in your career too?
I think it did, but I think it helped me out later. So I was very boisterous when I first joined the military. And then I got humbled right around the time I was about 21, 22 years old. And after that, along with my father constantly giving me the advice of, hey, don't be the loudest guy in the room. Don't make yourself out to be something more than you actually are. Just sit back and let others sing your praise. Don't sing your own praise. And after getting beaten down a little bit and getting a little humbled, that was when I sort of took a step back of, okay, I'm not the greatest thing since sliced bread just because I wear a uniform. Let me actually, develop a personality outside of just that.
Let's talk a little more about your family history. I know that there was some turmoil in there. You talk about it, you mention it a little bit. Can we go into that a little bit about the turmoil? Because I think it pays off in your writing, but it also kind of pays off in your life story too.
Yeah, sure. So there was a little bit of turmoil in that my folks got separated very early on. My parents divorced when I was a year old, which made it kind of weird. Not that because they were divorced, but because I just grew up with it. So, you'd be over at a friend's house and their parents would ask you what your family situation was like. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, my parents are divorced. They'd be like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'd be like, why? Yeah, because it was just how I grew up. And of course, there were difficulties that came with that. Different relatives, step parents, mainly, stepfathers in particular. And nothing too egregious, just, sort of once you get the half siblings involved and all that, priorities shift. And that led to a lot of feelings of inadequacy growing up, and what sort of that led to me being the boisterous, very cocky, I have a lack of self-confidence, therefore I'm going to project self-confidence that I didn't actually have at the time. And but as I got older and realized why I was the way I was with a lot of that, it allowed me to take that step back, learn, and then grow from it.
Well, you said stepfather, so can we talk about how many came in and out? Because that can be a very tumultuous thing for a kid growing up if there's different ones. And then, of course, like you said, when the half siblings get involved, how many did it end up being for you total between dad and mom?
So I'm incredibly blessed on my father's side. I've had one stepmother who came into my life when I was three, and she's been here ever since. And she's treated me like her own child. So I actually am still incredibly lucky and blessed to have her in my life because she's been one of my biggest champions through everything, to include the writing. On my mother's side, total number is officially one, but then there were a couple of other long-term relationships that were in there too.
So, are you still close with the parents and stuff? Because sometimes you'll see that separation. Like you said that your stepmom's been there your whole life, so I'm sure your dad's been kind of a stationary factor there too. Are you as close with both parents? Did you kind of pick your way? Did you pick, I guess you would say, a side growing up?
No, I'm still very close with both of my parents. I've always been I've always been a daddy's boy. My father has always just been Superman in my eyes, from as long as I can remember to even now at almost 30 years old. So that's just always been the consistent.
Well, and you mention him a lot. You talk about the reading, and him even bringing you the first book that really kind of got you hooked into reading, got you hooked into the genre, and you were like 10, 12 years old, and he brought you Rainbow Six. Now, it makes me feel extremely old because I was in the military when Rainbow Six came out, stationed over in Hawaii. So I'm a little torn at that statement, but he was the one that kind of fostered that in you. Did you find that gave you something more to look for just than military service? You were looking kind of on the backside of it and saying, this is what maybe I would like to do later on in life?
For becoming a writer,
For the
is that what you
writing,
mean?
because I know from a very young age you wanted to be a writer, but did that really kind of spur you on, like, hey, I'm going to do the military, but in the end, I think I'm going to end up being this?
I'd say 85% that was the case because so Rainbow Six and him introducing it was definitely what got me into the idea of, whoa, this is one of the coolest things I've ever read. I want to eventually create something like this myself. And then, so I did. I've always been very lucky to have a very creative, overactive imagination. I was writing in middle school, I was writing in high school, and I was about 22, 23, and I had finally locked in the very, very first serious draft of Deception. And I went and I brought it to him, and I was like, "Hey, I wrote this. I'm really enjoying the writing. It might be something I want to do." And he said, "That's great, but do it as a hobby. Set yourself up professionally, financially, to where you have food on the table, money in the bank, and you're able to take care of yourself and your future family. And then once you've got that set, focus on the writing." And so I've always, I took that to heart. And since then, I've approached writing as more of a hobby. If someone comes forward and they want to write me a big check and say, "Hey, we want to buy the rights and have you keep doing this," I won't say no. But until that happens, I'm probably going to having my cake and eating it too, where I can continue the contracting and I did my service in the military and I get to do something that I enjoy, which is the writing.
Well, and before we get into the military service, some people could take that as if their parents say, you know what, don't quit your day job, keep, food on the table, money in the bank, as they don't trust in you to make that a real dream happen. But I have a feeling from talking to you and knowing about your past that that wasn't true at all, that you really kind of took it the other way and said, okay, he's just telling me logically how to deal with the future.
Yeah, exactly. And of course that would have been about 7 years ago. So the world was still a fairly stable place compared to even where it is now. I couldn't imagine. I would hate writing if we were in the current situation that we're in economically, as a country, and I had to rely on book royalties to be able to pay my bills, and I didn't have a giant publisher behind me. I would hate it. It would be so stressful. I'd be like, "Oh, I should have just stayed contracting." So I'm very happy that he set me on that direction with that advice.
Well, and with your military career, it's a little after 9/11. So there was some time in between when 9/11 happened, when you joined, and there was an 8 year kind of span of your career. But you started kind of like I started my career. You went your junior year to basic training, then went back after your senior year, did your AIT. Then I did a year of college, and then I went active duty. Kind of the same with you. You went a little earlier by doing that split op. When you join, is any of that in your head about 9/11? Because a lot of guys that come on the show and talk, that was a big thing. That's what got them to join. That made a lot of people very patriotic. But we're talking, you're quite a few years after that happened. At first, do you remember any of that? And did any of that have any factor with what you were going to do in the military?
So I do remember 9/11. I was young. I was, let's see, 2001. I was 7 when the towers went down. I turned 8 2 months later, but I do remember it. I was living with my mother at the time, and we were in Fishkill, New York. So we were far enough away from the city, because that's about 60 miles northwest of New York City, that we weren't pulled out of school. We went home at a normal time. So I didn't really see anything about it until I got home and the news was on. And, 7 years old, I didn't really understand. The biggest thing I understood about terrorism was to loop back to Rainbow Six, was the Rainbow Six video game on PC and how they would talk about terrorists. But I didn't know what that was. And then they were the guys with the red bandanas that I had to shoot.
Of course.
And actually, it was, but it was because, when I went and saw my father, I think it was that weekend. It might have been a couple of weekends after, because if I remember correctly, he actually got activated to go down to the city. But he basically sat me down and explained that, yeah, there are bad people in the world. And I think that was where it was fully locked in that I was going to go in the military at some point. Now, fast forward 2011, I am 17 years old. I enlist on May 11th, and that is 9 days after they had killed bin Laden. But I was still locked in, and I had even voice. I was like, they got him. Like, is the war going to be over? And my dad was like, no. He goes, you've got nothing to worry about. And so, I was all in on it to name drop book number three.
What was it about the job intel analyst that you took? And maybe describe a little bit about what you did, but what it was about that job that kind of pulled you in, because it's an important job. Plus, it's a extensive school at Fort Huachuca. So, what brought you into that?
My dad did. I just wanted to join. I would have walked in that recruiter's office and taken any job they gave me. At that point, I just wanted to be in the military. And it was because I was doing a split option that, as you have to have your parents sign a permission slip pretty much for you. And so I went to my dad because a guy a year above me, my buddy Dan Hall, he had done the split option. He came home and was in the army. We were all like, what do you mean you're in the army? And he explained it to us and did the math, which I probably shouldn't have done because I'm terrible at math. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm going to be 17. I'm going to be able to do this. So I went and I pitched it to my dad. And he goes, I'll sign for you, but I'm going to pick your job. And I'm like, whatever. I don't care. I just want to be in the military. And so he picked it. And like I said, I would have taken anything. They were throwing mortuary affairs, laundry repair specialists. The National Guard was like, we'll do infantry, which I would have just jumped on in a second. But my dad was like, nope, you're going to go intel if you're going to join early. And I was like, done. I want to join early. And of course, once we asked about it, they showed me all the stuff, intel, you're going to be doing spy stuff and X, Y, and Z. And actually, I remember I got into a couple of arguments with my dad afterward when I'd come back home from basic before I'd gone to AIT because I was like, man, I should be going infantry, I should be kicking in doors and X, Y, and Z. I don't want to go intel. He goes, just wait. He goes, get through the schoolhouse and you'll see that this was the right decision for you. And he turned out to be right. I went through Huachuca. I did my 5 months, 4.5, 5 months down there. And I fell in love with it. Fell in love with the job. I was so happy that he got me into it. And I'm even happier now because I've got all this experience behind me. And it's landed me in some really cool places, working with some really cool people. And I asked him about it a couple of years afterward. I was like, of all the jobs, why did you tell me to go intel? And he said, because I knew you would like it. He goes, I know you better than you know yourself and probably better than you will ever know yourself. And I had you dialed in that you'd want to do intel. And he's batting 1,000 right now because he did the same thing with my younger brother. He guided him to go cyber in the Air Force because that's where my brother's interests and skills lie. Man, he did it. Man, he nailed it. So, to make a short story long, my dad is the reason I ended up in intel.
Well, let's talk about a little of what you did and how that not only worked for you while you were in the military, how it worked for you in the contracting world, and then it kind of really paid off when you started writing.
Yeah, so where do you want me to start? just from the
beginning.
Let's
talk about what you did in the military, like what your actual job was, because I don't know that a lot of people would know exactly what that does.
Yeah, so I was a 35 Foxtrot, which is the Army's MOS designator for an all-source intelligence analyst. And what an all-source intelligence analyst does is we take intel from all the other disciplines, human intelligence, signals intelligence, imagery analysis, all those other guys, and the raw work that they put out, and we take that and we compile it into products that are digestible and presentable to commanders, be it from your platoon leader all the way up to the 2-star, once you get into certain units, to 3 and 4 stars. And so we, you know, the joke is we like to control C, control V. We copy and paste a lot of stuff, but it's very much taking all intel is taking a bunch of information and trimming the fat down to what's important. And then all source guys will do that and do it even more so we can fit it all into one slide. And then we can brief whoever needs to know that information.
But that's kind of an art form to know exactly what fat to cut off to make it, because it's very mission essential information that you're giving out. And when I say mission essential, you are the bare bones mission essential information to keep people safe and to keep the mission driving forward. So you gloss over that, but it's a very much of an art form to do that. How does that build up into you? How do you get good at that? And how do you get good at that quickly before you get out into the real world doing it?
The best way to get good at it is just practice and exposure to different mission sets, different types of requirements, and different leaders who are going to have different priorities. I would say the most interesting part about being an all-source analyst between the Army and contracting is every single place I've been to and command that I've worked under has been sort of relearning it from the get-go. The processes are all pretty much the same, but it's okay, what are they looking for? What, you know, what's important here that wasn't important previously, and vice versa? How do I adjust my toolbox and skill set to be able to perform quickly and provide the maximum amount of intel and information in the minimal amount of time based on what the priorities for the mission are? So what I was doing with the civil affairs unit in Africa was, you know, a couple months later, I was in Afghanistan on my first contract supporting Task Force 20, you know, the Green Berets out there in Paktia province. It was a completely different mission with a complete tool set. And I had to do a lot of very quick learning very fast, because that was from, you know, jumping from a reserve CA to active duty soft support was like going from peewee to the big leagues. And I hope that works out. I'm not a sports guy, so my sports analogies are probably going to be very off. But then it's been great, because every single job has given me new skills and new tools to take to the next one. I guess the best way to describe it would be it's the reverse of a self-licking ice cream cone, because the skill set and the job builds upon itself. And so every job I've had as an analyst has made me a better analyst.
You talked about wanting to go in at whatever they would give you, but then you really started arguing with your dad about infantry, that you should be kicking in doors, that you felt this need to go do that. Once again, you didn't go do that. You're doing very much the opposite. You're in the background briefing people that are going to go kick the doors. So how does that affect you mentally when you're doing that? Because the whole time you're thinking about doing what they're doing.
You know, I really never thought about it. Basically, I knew that I had my lane and my job, and that if I didn't do my job right, they wouldn't be able to do their jobs, or my biggest fear, they wouldn't all make it home, whether it be from the mission or from the deployment. And so, yeah, it'd be great to be out there to be doing what they're doing. But, you know, once the rubber hits the road, I don't have, you know, there's no time to sit there and do the, you know, shoulda, coulda, woulda. I've got a job, so I can make sure they can do a job. And, you know, it just made it very easy to put those bumpers and blinders up and just do what needed to be done.
So never at any point were you like, maybe I should have done a different job, because you go the contracting route, but you're still doing intel in the contracting route. Now, I'm sure there's a little more hands-on stuff in the contracting world. but never look back?
Nah. Maybe when I was in my early 20s, I had a lot of thinking about it and a little bit of remorse. But then once I was lucky enough to get into the world of contracting and just so many opportunities opened up to support even, higher tiers of dudes who do that stuff and other very niche missions that I never would have gotten a chance to do otherwise had I shifted to a different job or, stayed in the reserves at that point. So definitely no remorse nowadays.
You said that you got humbled when you were in your probably early 20s and stuff. Can we talk about how you were humbled? Because it would be interesting to hear that, because you still stuck around. You kind of rolled with the punches, but you were humbled. So can we talk about any of those incidences that where you felt like, okay, maybe I should shut my mouth and just do my job?
Yeah, so actually, the humbling came from college, of all places. I was enrolled at Valley Forge Military College in Pennsylvania. I was in the ROTC program, and I was a couple months away from commissioning. And I won't get too into the details with this just because there is still an ongoing appeal, whether and that should be resolved in the next couple months. So hopefully, if we're able to do this again, I'll be able to talk more in depth about it. But there was an incident that I was implicated in that I actually didn't do anything wrong with. And just to preface, because people are already going to think the worst, it wasn't anything sexual assault, sexual harassment related. But basically, I had a bunch of other cadets band together against me and make it out like I was the problem. And I lost my scholarship and was kicked out of the ROTC program. And a lot, there was the cooperation and collusion against me, but I facilitated it being as loud and boisterous and cocky as I was. Had I just kept my mouth shut, not thought I was the best thing since sliced bread, it probably wouldn't have gone that way. And so after a lot of just so much like introspection and retrospection of looking back, that was the biggest thing that humbled me of like, okay, I don't need to be like that. And had I not been like that, I would be in a vastly different situation right now. Now, that being said, I wouldn't change where I'm at for the world, but that was the big humbling moment for me.
Is there any more that we can know about that? Because that's kind of a cliffhanger of I know you're very good at leaving people in suspense, but is there anything that we can talk about with that? Because the reason I want to talk about that incident in particular is because I think that it changed a lot of things for you moving forward, because you once again lose your scholarship. You're humbled in front of a lot of people, and it kind of changes the trajectory of where you're going. So, what was it about this incident that made it kick off from the very beginning?
Personality clashes and a lack of accountability at several levels from cadets and school leadership. There was an incident involving a couple of other cadets that I was asked to intervene with. I don't know why. I didn't have any involvement with the incident. It got escalated on a school level. Things were mishandled there. So then I brought it up to the ROTC leadership. It was addressed. Certain cadets in the ROTC cadet leadership chain of command, who I already didn't have the greatest relationship with, had taken that as a slight against them. Things escalated over time. And basically, the best way to sort of sum it up and leave it on a cliffhanger, and less of a cliffhanger, is it was a fight that I was involved in that I neither started nor threw a punch in, but was the only one held accountable for.
Anything that you regret from that incident?
Getting involved when I had no need to get involved, from when I was asked to intervene, I should have just directed them to the leadership and been like, sorry, but I've got no skin in this game. So there's no way I can actually help you out.
So do you think it was that ego that was driving you, that I'll do this, I'll be in charge, I'll take care of this? Do you think that's what it was, that bravado of I'm more valuable than I really am?
It was a combination of that and a little bit of like savior slash hero complex at the time.
In your career, does that ever affect you later on, whether that be in contracting, whether that be in just regular military? Does that ever kind of lurk up in the background and you go, yeah, I think I'll steer clear of this? Or do you take the opposite role and go headlong into more things?
It's made it very, very easy to stay out of office drama and not get embroiled in anything like that. I would say professionally, though, it's never really come up in contracting so much of charging headlong into being, you know, being the righteous man, you know, because I've been very fortunate that there haven't been any situations, at least in contract, required me to have to make that decision. But for the short stint that I was working hospital security, it was great because that was my whole job, was to be there to protect people.
From everything that I get about that job, why you're doing that, why you are doing the split option and going into contracting, as a final point of it, is you really didn't like that world that you were in. You didn't like the job that you were in. You wanted something more out of life.
Are you talking when I was working like regular day jobs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was a period of time after college. Well, I guess I was still in college at that point, but I was doing it online, where I had worked a couple different day jobs. So I'd worked in a medical warehouse shipping department that, you know, I was the happiest person in the building when I got let go from that after my probationary period. After that, I was an overnight janitor at a Planet Fitness for a couple months. And then I got picked up for the hospital security gig. But I felt stuck at that point. You know, I'd been humbled by the whole ROTC thing. I'd been hit with a bill for the entire sum of that scholarship amount at that point. Yeah, I was in school at Norwich doing my bachelor's, and I was doing the reserve thing at the time. But it just, I had this overbearing feeling of like, I'm never going to leave my hometown. And it was terrible because I'd had these great goals before of going into the military and then going, you know, once I was an officer, going active duty, trying out for Special Forces selection. And it had all just come crashing and burning at that point. And the wound was still very, very raw at that point, because my scholarship thing was in early 2015, and we're talking 2016, 2017 at this point. So I had yet to have that wound scab over and start to heal and turn into a scar, to be melodramatic. And yeah, I hated it. I was like, I could be doing so much more with myself, and this is where I am, not knowing that things were in the works that would eventually propel me in the direction that I wanted to go in, and that would lead me to where I am now.
Did you ever talk to anyone about it? Did you talk to your dad? Did you talk to friends and say, like, this is not me, but I can't figure out how to be me?
I did, but I was not nearly, I didn't have the emotional maturity at that point as I was rebuilding myself to approach it like that. It was very much a, this sucks, I don't want to be here. You know, I was all complaints, no solutions. And it was very much, yeah, and my dad was my main sounding board, and he still is to this day. But he was like, just give it time. He goes, just keep working, finish school. Once you're done with school, we can start game planning. You know, we'll figure out what's next for you. And I would be like, oh, like, you know, that's, of course, you know, when you're all exasperated and just desperate for any kind of direction and guidance and answer, that's the worst thing to hear. And especially because at that point, around mid-2017, my unit was doing this will they, won't they, of if we were going to Africa or not. So that was when I had started putting my feelers out to try to get on a contracting gig. And I'd gotten responses for two, and then they both fell through because the companies didn't win the contract. So I was like, oh, like, I'm, you know, I'm casting the line, but I'm still not getting anything. And it was very, very disheartening at the time, but I'm so glad that I took his advice and just stick it out, you know, finish school, and then things just fell into place for me.
Did he ever tell you at any point, like, I told you, shut the fuck up and don't be the loudest one in the room, and you didn't listen? Is there ever that discussion with him?
Oh, all the time. And I tell him all the time that I'd wished so much, you know, knowing what I know now, that I listened to him at the time. And he goes, "Well, I did tell you." And I'm like, "I know you did."
When you look back on that, do you think, I ask a lot of people this, do you think everything happens for a reason?
I do. I really do. And of course, you don't think about it at the time. And me, yeah, if I'm having a rough day, I'll tell it to myself and it helps me calm down a little bit. But back then, it didn't work as much. But I think that everything does happen for a reason. What that reason is, I don't know. You know, that's decided by a power bigger than me, bigger than any of us. But I know that I would be in a much, much different position in life had things not, had that turning point not happened in 2015. And I don't know if it would be better or not. I know that I'd probably be an officer. I don't know whether I would have gone active duty or not. I don't know whether I would have stayed intel or not, but I don't, and you know, I don't know if I would have pursued the writing in the way that I have, because I wouldn't have the life experiences that I've had since that really ended up sort of forming the final stories in the modern mercenary thrillers and even in Occupant. So yeah, I do think that everything happens for a reason, and I'm very thankful that things have gone the way they have, because I've done so much learning and growing because of, you know, to quote my father, no one grows from success. It's those failures. And when you've got to pull yourself up after you're broken and bloody and just, you know, want to give up, that's when you really find yourself. You find out what you're made of and what you're capable of.
From 2018 to 2022, you're back to back to back deployments. And as a matter of fact, when we get to it, you landed Gitmo on a contract 10 days after you left Afghanistan. So I want to get into that, but let's first talk about the Horn of Africa, kind of what you were doing over there, how you got your feet wet, and how that led you into the world of contracting.
Yeah, so 2018, January 2018, was when our deployment started. I was with the 404th Civil Affairs Battalion. We did the Horn of Africa rotation out in Camp Lemonnier, which is in Djibouti, which most people can't find on a map. And it was a pretty good deployment for the most part. A couple of hiccups here and there. It was a good deployment because it was very low op tempo. I mean, Djibouti is a very permissive environment. I got scuba certified out there. You know, people always hear Horn of Africa and they're like, "Oh man, you were out there like trading shots with Al-Shabaab, right?" And I'm like, no, I wasn't. You know, we'd go out in civilian clothes and soft-skinned Hiluxes and do our engagements, our assessments and all that. But I was one of two intel guys out there. It was me and a captain. And so I was very much in an intel seat, but wearing a civil affairs hat as much as I could without being a qualified 38 series. I don't remember the actual designator. That exposed me. You know, that gave me basically my first exposure to real world active duty intel and joint operations. And, you know, we had some exposure to some soft dudes out there, from the Army, Navy and the Air Force, actually. And that really locked, the biggest thing that I got from that deployment was it locked me into not wanting to do any menial day jobs anymore. And it really lit the fire under my ass. So we were there from January to October, got back in October, immediately just started blasting my resume out to everyone. I applied to several government jobs and I applied to probably about 100 different contracts at that point, which was maybe a drop in the bucket because Afghanistan was still very much active at that point. So yeah, that's what really got me started. And you know, having that sort of independence as one of two intel guys, where if we didn't have any priorities, I was making up my products as I went along of going, "Hey, this is where we're lacking. You know, we've been in this location for 20 some years at this point. Why don't we have X, Y, and Z?" And so I take that upon myself to do. And that very much, like I said, it lit the fire under my ass to be a better analyst and to be proactive.
So what rank are you at this time?
I was a specialist. I was an E4.
Okay. So this is where it gets kind of confusing for me. So you're doing contracting work, but you haven't finished out your military time, right? You're still considered reserve, guard. I think guard, right?
At that point, I was reserves. Okay. I was in the guard from 2011 to 2016.
Okay. So you're in the reserves at this point. So 2011 to 2016 is, you're doing 5 years out of that 8 years. So you're an E4. Are you looking towards sergeant, anything like that? And then how are you, I say that, and the points are high and all that kind of stuff. I get all that. But what I'm asking is, because when you're setting as a specialist, contracting work looks very healthy. It's a very sexy job, because being a specialist and doing something and being a contractor, I would think are two way different worlds. So how are you balancing the reserve thing with going to work as a contractor?
So we got back, and like I said, we got back in October of 2018, and I started putting my feelers out. And once I got locked into the Afghan contract, because I was going to leave in January, I threw a Hail Mary and I was like, hey, S1, I'm going on this contract. I need to go into the IRR. And they were like, okay. They were like, here's the paperwork you need to submit. When do you leave? And I was like, January of 2019. They're like, all right, we'll see what we can do. And I got the unicorn. I went into the IRR. They put me on interim status in, I think, November, December of 2018. But my orders didn't kick over until July of 2019. But yeah, so I didn't really have to worry about balancing it at that point. I wasn't drilling. I wasn't on any kind of active military status because they were able to shift me over to the IR. And actually, that's how I finished out my military career. I got my discharge paperwork in the mail last May.
Are you disappointed with that in finishing? Because you laugh about it, and of course you joke about it and stuff, but are you disappointed and that's the way it ended? Or once again, do we go back to the thing of everything happens for a reason, I'm happy that I went into contracting, but is there that little tinge of disappointment in it?
Just the tiniest tinge, because I know that had I stayed in and been more active on it, I would have made at least E5. Which, not for lack of trying, I can go on for that in a little bit. But I would have made E5. I probably would have been at least a squad leader or a section NCO. And I could have used all of the experiences I had, both between ROTC, the guard, and the reserves, for both the good leadership and the bad leadership on the NCO and officer side, to affect change, to make sure that at least my notional Joes in this scenario would have been taken care of. That's really my only source of regret in that whole scenario.
You move over into contracting, you go to Afghanistan, you take this. Is it a different kind of world once you get there? Because yes, you did it in the military for a little bit, but once again, we talk about you're an E4, not really in charge of that much stuff. As a contractor, you got to kind of put on your big boy pants immediately and take charge, because they're looking for production and they're looking for the best of the best because they're paying the best of the best. So how is that shock going from one world to the other?
Well, the learning curve was definitely there, and it was less of a curve and more of a very steep mountain. But I was extremely lucky to have a good team out there who were patient with me when they would go, okay, we need you to do X, Y, and Z. Do you know how to work this system? And I would just be like, no, like, I've never even heard of this system. They'd be like, okay, we're going to sit down and we're going to work with you. Sometimes they'd be like, why do you not know this? I'd be like, I came from the guard and the reserves. They'd be like, that makes sense. All right, we're going to get you spun up. And I think it was that, at this point, was when I had started really growing and humbling myself. I didn't need to chest beat and be like, oh yeah, I know everything about that system. And only when they're like, why didn't you produce what we've asked you to produce? Have to stumble through some kind of BS excuse. No, I was just honest with them about what I knew versus what I didn't. and they helped me get spun up very quick. But I did those first, I'd say those first 2 months in Afghanistan, it was just drinking from the fire hose every night, and just learning as much as I could. And thankfully, I ended up taking over a very niche position, doing counter VBID and battle damage assessment reporting. And so once I was locked in with that, it was very much a you're going to get a deluge of information to sift through, but you've also got one product a week to make. So I was able to, I had time, which I was very, very fortunate to have. So I was able to sit down and learn what to do. And yeah, my first couple ones were probably a 65% firing solution, but each week it got better and I was able to bounce off the other guys, both the other officers and green suiters that we had in the office. And eventually I got locked in and it really helped springboard me from that, E4 that kind of knew his job to, okay, I'm actually a competent contractor who can keep up with the big dogs and really justify my existence out here now in about the span of 2.5 months.
Well, and that was my next question was, at any point in contracting work, do you ever look and go, I didn't know a fucking thing about what was going on. I could float through as an E4 and kind of just, go below the radar, and I didn't know shit about what I needed to know.
I had that conversation today, joking about it, because it was a very basic, hey, do you know how to actually read these sort of admin sections of this report to see if it's, the guy who wrote it actually knows what they're talking about or not? I was like, no, I just always went off of the main body. And he went through it, and I was like, man, I wish they taught me that when I was in the army. So yeah, I have that realization all the time, baby 23-year-old specialist Zach James, he'd be so lost in the sauce if he was where I am now.
As you go through, how long is that trip to Afghanistan?
That was just shy of 8 months. I was there from late January to early August of 2019.
When you're there, are you looking already for the next contracting gig? Or are you looking to go home and kind of relax for a minute? I know you said that it lit the fire, but are you already actively seeking that next contracting gig because it comes into very much the next thing that you do?
So I wasn't actively looking at that point. I always had my LinkedIn and my clearance shop set to just ping my resume out pretty regularly. And so I was actually on R&R in Dubai with my dad, my stepmother, and my brother. And I got hit up for a position doing analyst work down in Guantanamo Bay in Gitmo. And I looked over it. And yeah, I was taking a little bit of a hit money-wise, but I would have been going from 72 hours a week to 40 hours a week. I was going from living in a Connex box to living in a townhouse with one other person. And the biggest thing for me is, when am I ever going to get the chance to go to Gitmo again? This is very much the golden goose to someone like me, because I've always had a weird infatuation with Cuba as it is. And so I literally, we sat down for dinner that night. I think we went to a TGI Fridays. Leave it to the Americans to go to fucking Dubai and eat at a TGI Fridays at one point. I know we had dinner there, and then we went to a Baskin Robbins for dessert. And we were sitting there, and I told my dad that I got the offer letter and all that, and we sat down with it. And he goes, listen, he goes, we'll support you whatever you want to do. You just got to make, the decision is yours. And I was like, well, I really like what I'm doing in Afghanistan, and I've got a great crew out there. I mean, to the point where from that crew in Afghanistan, four of us now live within 30 minutes of each other here in Virginia. And we all ended up working in the same building at one point years later. I was like, but I don't think I'm going to get this chance again. So I jumped on it. And then I got back to Afghanistan a couple of days later. And I think it was while I was sitting in Warrior waiting for my helicopter to. Because I think it flew out to back down from Bagram to Paktia the next day. That was when I typed up and sent in my letter of resignation.
Feel bad about it at all doing that? Because, like you said, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, but but you have a good team down there. You've actually kind of established yourself as someone who knows what they're doing, because as we talked about in the past, that wasn't really a thing. Is there any kind of heartburn with you about doing that?
I wish I'd waited out and finished out the year and then jumped on the Gitmo gig, because, you know, knowing what I know now, they still would have needed some bodies down there. That's really the only heartburn I have, is would have been finishing out the year, you know, making it to January, maybe going home for a month and then jumping over to the island. But other than that, no, I don't really have any regrets.
Yeah, because you mentioned going home for a month. You literally went to Gitmo 10 days after you left Afghanistan, kind of cleared yourself up, went to Gitmo. And how long are you at Gitmo?
I was at Gitmo from, I have a funny story about the turnaround too, but I was at Gitmo from August of 2019 to February 28th of 2020.
So, I mean, you've been gone for a while out of your life. And I have to ask you, you know, without going into a cutter and all those kind of things, how does that affect relationships, you know, having a life other than contracting?
Really, the only thing that it affects is being homesick and not being able to make a couple hour drive north to see my parents if I want to. Other than that, I've done the long distance thing a couple times and nothing really, unfortunately, didn't really pan out for one reason or another. But other than that, just being a little homesick to, you know, be able to hang out with my parents and my brother and all that doesn't really affect anything. I live a pretty streamlined life for that reason. Because I knew that if I had the girlfriend or, you know, or the wife and kids and all that, I don't think I'd be able to make the same decisions I made and have, you know, still currently making if I had those attachments compared to nowadays.
Okay, but let's look into the future now. When all this goes away, and you have to think forward to the future. I know that it's hard to do sometimes. When it's all said and done, when you're not contracting anymore, do you think that kind of decision is going to bite you in the ass in the end?
I don't really know. I guess I'd sort of take I'll cross that bridge when I get there approach to it. But it also sort of falls back to everything happens for a reason. And I'm taking steps now to where when the time comes when I do eventually have a family, well, I say when, if hopefully I end up eventually having a family of my own, that even if I do have that sort of heartburn of, oh, I wish I'd stayed in contracting or whatever, it won't be because, oh, I need the money or, oh, we're in pretty dire straits. It'll be just more so, I wish I'd done a little more action in my life.
Well, and I'm even looking from the opposite view of it. Let's say that the kids aren't there. Let's say that the wife's not there. At the end of it, you got a fridge full of beer and a phone book full of phone numbers. Do you think that when you look back on it, that it will be worth it? Because you just said, I won't ever worry about this, but I'll worry about maybe I didn't have enough action or enough adventure in my life. On the opposite side of that coin, do you think you'll get there and go, maybe I had too much adventure and now I'm on the backside of it and what do I do now?
You know, I never really thought of it from that aspect.
Well, I'm glad I could put that out to you.
I think at that point, I'll just wander into the woods and, you know, my legacy will live on.
And the reason I ask that is because, kind of touching on your books really quickly, all of your characters have a lot of action and adventure in their lives, but they have other halves. They have wives, they have girlfriends, they have all these things. And I wonder when you say stuff like that, like, I don't really care if I have this and I'm very streamlined in life. You obviously care about it subconsciously because you write about it in your books, and all these people have people to fall back on later on in life. And those relationships, they do fall back on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess for me personally, my sort of XP for that right now is my parents, and specifically my dad. You know, he's the guy that I can always pick up the phone whenever I need him. And admittedly, and I won't get too into into the details of this, but back in 2021, I was in a relationship that I thought was going to be it, and I was ready to hang up the life because of the situation. You know, she works for the federal government and all that, and there were certain changes that would have been okay. I got to make sacrifices to make your dreams happen, and I'm okay with that. And then all that fell through in a pretty unfortunate way. And I'd be lying if I said it hadn't made me a little jaded and shifted my mindset a little bit. Now I'm not looking to be like Clint Tyron living in a cabin up in the woods somewhere, but it's shifted my priorities a little bit from that. And I don't know if that's just because I haven't fully recovered from it. There's still a lot of stuff that I'm working through on that, you know, in introspection wise. And I think that's why I place more of an emphasis on that for my characters than I do for myself in real life right now.
Well, but I think you just made a very good point. You said your dad was the one that you call, that you can rely on to, you know, be a sounding board for. And Clint is that for Morgan. So there is something there with the characters that you write. I mean, as much as we want to go around it, that it's very true. And so that's what I've always wondered. And especially looking through your stuff, like I was looking, okay, he's in Afghanistan, then he's in Gitmo, then he's here, and then he's there, and then he's in Washington, then he's in Virginia. And there's like no personal kind of information in there. There's no personal life in there. And I wonder, when you look at it, do you go, you know, that was good or that was bad? And, you know, it could go both ways, but with you explaining that you were getting ready to hang up the life, and now, do you think you won't do it for a long time now because of that happening?
I think at this point, if I was to hang up the life, it would be less because of a relationship. Not that I would complain if that was the case, and more so because I was trying to live that Yellowstone life of like going back up to New York and living on the property with my parents and working that and getting all the livestock. And that's funny that you brought up the whole sort of lack of personal life in the bio thing, because I was actually looking over the bio earlier and I was like, wow, I gave him a very bare bones. Like, this almost reads like a resume. And I felt kind of bad about that. But I think that also sort of goes back to the whole don't be boisterous, don't really fluff yourself up mentality, too. And also, just my personal life is pretty boring other than the book stuff, if I'm being completely honest.
And I agree with you. And when you say that it was a bare bones bio, I agree with that point too. But I also look at, there are things that you can sprinkle into there. You're a writer. There are things that you can sprinkle in about your personal life that kind of show that it's the world around you. Now, your writing and stuff, I feel like it really comes out. A lot of your thoughts come out there, because even when I've seen you on another podcast, when you've talked, when you do your Instagram, all that kind of stuff, it's mainly about you just get right to the point and you talk about what you're doing. With that, and looking at the books, I feel like a lot of your thoughts go into those characters. And one that I want to bring up is the PTS, because you talk about it a lot in there about PTS. Can we talk about how you came up with that for your characters?
Yeah, so a little bit of that is from personal experience. Admittedly, less from anything I've experienced in the military or contracting, and actually a lot of it at the time came from when I worked at the hospital. Whether it was working and we had to be on standby for a particularly bad trauma, or some of the situations we had to get into in dealing with the folks up on the behavioral health unit and being exposed to that at a fairly young age. And it's different, you know, of course you see stuff like that on the TV and the movies and all that. But then when you're in the room and you've got the sight, you know, all the senses are going, sight, smell, touch, taste sometimes, unfortunately, it's, you know, it brings it home. And so that went into it, and then I've got a lot of friends who were in SOF in different elements, and I've been pretty lucky to be a confidant for them with some of the things that they've been through and they've talked about. And actually, I want to give a big shout out to Mr. Tom Satterly, author of All Secure. His book opened up a lot of that too. And so I wanted to, for the PTS, I wanted to use a little bit of my experience and then use what I'd heard and learned from some of those other guys in a way that wasn't, I wanted to avoid getting tropey with it and write it in a way where it was realistic, but it also did it right by the guys who do suffer from that to a much more severe degree. And especially those dudes at the tip of the spear who have been, you know, they've been through those major losses and have lived that high octane life. And so that's where that came from.
Do you ever, in your writing, do you ever put a piece of you into it, some of your career, some of the contracting, or do you rely on those stories that come in from around you?
I'll put a little bit of my career here and there in certain aspects, but I try to do it in a way where I know that there is absolutely zero chance of any kind of cross-contamination that could lead to a section needing to be redacted, especially after going through all the appeals to get all this stuff unredacted in the first two books. So like in like it'll be like a lot of locational stuff more than anything and less operational. So like when I'm able to talk, you know, I've got the sections that take place in Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti. I know what they look like and how to describe them because I was there. But then there will be other things like in a future book, there are sections that take place in Gitmo. Well, for that, to ensure that I have zero bleed over from anything that I actually worked with, I created a whole fictional section and a whole fictional camp, you know, and that was a lot of fun to come up with the backstory. So in that aspect, I do pull from myself, but and then I try not to pull too much from other people's stories because they're not my stories to tell or reference in that aspect outside of the, okay, how do I, you know, how do I accurately describe what it feels like when this type of PTS induced panic attack versus an anxiety attack or, you know, triggered by olfactory reactions and all that. Outside of that, though, I try to avoid using too much of the shiny rocks that I've been lucky enough to have been made privy to because those aren't my stories to tell.
Have you ever thought about going into that and writing those stories, working with those people and writing those stories?
Without getting too much into it, I am currently working on something like that.
Do you worry that when you get into that world and it surrounds you, because writing is going to take its toll on you. It's a long, arduous process with you dealing with the stories that you're hearing, the emotions that are dealt out when those stories are given. Do you ever worry about too much of it coming in on you?
I don't worry about it now, but that's also because I'm coming at it from a place of ignorance and non-experience in writing in that realm. I like to think I'm fairly good at compartmentalizing, and I've gotten very good over the last probably about 2 years of knowing when to take a break and to take a step away. And that's one of the best things about being, you know, an independent author is I can do that. I work on my own timeline. So that is very much a bridge that I will cross when I get there, but I'm not terribly worried about it right now.
I love your books. I love the storylines of them. They're amazing. And especially being from what you said, and this is by no way a slight, you are a self-published author. Like, you are the marketing, you are the promotion,
Oh
you
yeah,
are
yes
the
I
production, you are
am.
everything involved with it. And I noticed that you posted the other day, I think that you said you had sold, you're almost to 1,000 books that you had sold. Is that correct?
Yep. When I made that post the other day, we were sitting at 935.
Okay.
And that was after so far as of this recording, I think we're at 102 now. but it's been 102 books sold this month alone, which has been my best sales month since I've started.
Right. And so here's my question to you. And I can tell you from doing this is kind of my side gig. Like you talked about this, that was your side gig. You have, a full career. Do you ever look at it and are frustrated? Because you see it, because your books are good, your writing is good, but you haven't broken down those main barriers where everyone can get to your stories. And believe me, I know I've felt it where I feel like it's a great product. Everyone should hear it. Everyone should do this, but it's not always there. Do you have those same kind of feelings?
All the time. Yeah, there's nothing worse than when I'll pull up. So my main two things are KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing for the print and the Kindle services, and then ACX for Audible. There's nothing worse than when you pull it up and you've got, a 3, 4 day stretch of, okay, yeah, no units sold, and maybe someone read 25 pages on the Kindle version because it's in Kindle Unlimited. It's like, oh, like what am I doing wrong? How do I, other than just dumping tens of thousands of dollars into these different marketing firms to spread the word for me, what am I doing wrong? How do I spread the message? And I'm also, I had a big setback when my old Instagram got nuked, and I had to start from scratch on that. So it's like, great, now I'm back at square one with that aspect, and I've got to figure out how to get the word out. And okay, now I got to figure out what the appropriate hashtags are that are trending so I can get that out just to try to get some exposure. But those frustrating days are, they're pretty often of just a, and that comes with the territory of being a self-published author, independent author. But then on the flip side, when I get that day where I sold six print books, three Kindle, and seven audiobooks in a day, it's like, oh, I'm doing it. I'm doing something right. So it's very much the high highs and the low lows that come with it.
Do you feel it's more rewarding knowing when this is all over and it's all said and done that you did it yourself?
Absolutely, 100%.
With your storyline, let's talk about, because you have started branching off, you're gonna, like you just said, go into nonfiction, but let's talk about these books right up front: Deception, Wet Work, All In. How you came up with the idea, what the idea is behind it, and where you're trying to go with this.
Oh man. All right. So how I came up with the idea. The idea started as a comedic short story that me and my buddies, Morgan and Vinny, wrote in the morning study hall of my senior year of high school. And it was a 38-page, just nonsensical romp through the Iranian desert. There were, or was, no, it was Pakistan, sorry. It was Pakistan in the original one. And there were tanks, and there were Russian paratroopers, and there was a, not Carl Gustav, what was the Davy Crockett nuclear device? And it didn't make sense, and it was goofy. And 18-year-old Zach Morgan and Vinny were just, we were laughing our asses off that we came up with this idea. And but that was it. So then I was in Intel school, and I came up with the sequel, which was just a rip off of the opening chapter of Metal Gear Solid 2. Of I was like, what if I just take these characters and put them on a tanker that gets hijacked? And I did that. And then Morgan, actually, he was like, what if Morgan went to Zimbabwe? I was like, that could be cool to work with. And so I had all these ideas, and they were these goofy, short of 20 to 30 page short stories. And then eventually, and of course I'm reading throughout this Tom Clancy, W.E.B. Griffin, Vince Flynn. I'm like, I really like these ideas. And I'd already come up with some other, I want to say original, but of course when you're a teenager, your original ideas are, well, I really like this movie and this video game, so I'm going to kind of combine these two. And I'm going to loosely base these characters off of me and my friends and just change their names and put them in the scenario and then just figure out where to go from there. And so it was a lot of that until probably, gosh, I was probably like 2016, 2017 when I was looking at it, and I was like, I think if I pull the skeleton out of this, I've got something really good to work with. And so then I took that and I was like, what are the main plot points I want to keep? What do I want to get rid of? So I got rid of the goofy comedy aspect completely, and I shifted it to be more of a Tom Clancy-esque thriller. And then I started building. I was like, okay, well, let me take the original draft and what was called Deception, the 20-page tanker story, combine those. Okay, well, that leaves me with a pretty good cliffhanger. Okay, I know where to go for, I know where to go forward with this from some of the other ones that were already written out. And I fleshed it out and I wanted to make it more realistic. I wanted to make it more hard hitting. Then I started getting some deployments under my belt. I got Africa, Afghanistan, and then Gitmo. And I was like, okay, let me go back. All right, well, this is completely wrong. I need to rework this and let me sprinkle in some details here. And this is how I would approach this. And then in 2020, I finally had Deception set. I sent it off to get reviewed by the DoD. And then COVID hit, and that completely jacked up my time frame. But then 2021 came around, and it was all set, blessed off of the DoD, and I blasted it out. So that was how they started.
What is your idea behind the storylines? What are we going to see throughout this? What are you trying to achieve with these three books? Because a lot of people don't start off with a trilogy. You have decided to do that. So what are we looking for from beginning to end? Because I've read the first one. I'm almost done with the second one. And there is definitely a trajectory where this storyline is going.
I would say the trajectory is, that's a tough one because I don't really write these with like an overarching message to walk away from. I just write them because I think that they're cool stories that people will enjoy, and that's been proven pretty true so far with the occasional 1 and 2 star reviews that I've gotten. But I would say the main trajectory to take away from this first trilogy, and there's a reason I say that, is that there are consequences when you take the gloves off and you throw everything into a fight. And funny enough, I'm now realizing that that has some ties back to some things that have happened in my life that we've talked about earlier in this podcast. So that's what I would say the main trajectory is for at least these first three books. Now, that being said, this series is not over with these three. I think I've already made some announcements, but if not, this could be the official announcement that book four is coming out next year. But while it takes place in the same universe, it follows a different group of characters, some of which you've already met, as like secondary ancillary characters in book one specifically, and they're dealing with a different threat. And but it all tie in later on in the series.
It's strange when you tell me, though, that you don't see any real overarching storyline, but there's definitely family, loyalty, deception. There's a ton of things in that first and second book, with the characters that have already been introduced, especially at the end of the first book. There's really some storylines there that drag forward into two. And like I said, I'm not to three yet, but it's weird to hear you say that you don't think that there's overarching kind of ideas or thoughts in there.
Yeah, I guess I could have worded that better. There are a lot of people that go out and they write a book specifically with the intention of telling a story that hammers home a message or a theme, that the reader will then lay awake at night or for the next couple of days thinking about. And I guess I did accomplish that, especially with the themes of loyalty, brotherhood, sticking through with people who take care of you, which are virtues that I live by. But I didn't write them with the explicit end goal of these are what I want the readers to think about when the final page has been read and they've closed the book and they're laying in bed afterward. Yeah, that wasn't really my goal at the time. And I wouldn't say it's even my goal now. I write because I love reading and I love the escapism of it.
Speaking of escapism, let's talk about the book that you just released. It got released a little early. It was supposed to come out on Halloween. There was some scheduling that got messed up, so it's out early. if I had to say, you know, how you said that you look back on, well, I like this story and I like this. It's very much reminiscent of Thing, Aliens versus Predator. There's a lot of different kind of tie-ins there. Let's talk about the new book that just came out and what your idea of breaking away from this thriller genre into, I would say, a horror genre.
Yeah, so Occupant was slated to come out on Halloween, which was just an arbitrary, okay, it's a sci-fi horror, let me release it on Halloween date. And yeah, some scheduling and admin stuff on the back end got messed up, so I decided to move the release date up to accommodate for that. Occupant was basically a love letter to those classic sci-fi horrors, you know, 1979's Alien, 86's Aliens, 1982's The Thing. We don't talk about the 2011 version. Even slightly more modern ones like Event Horizon, which I didn't realize at the time that I was putting elements of that into it, but some people read it, they were like, oh, I really like how you like reference Event Horizon. I was like, I didn't mean to, but I guess I did. And that came about because, so I was probably about 10 years old when I watched Aliens for the first time, and it scared the hell out of me. I couldn't sleep for like 3 days after. I was terrified. Face huggers, xenomorphs, shit bursting out of your chest, scared the shit out of young Zach. But after I got over that fear, I was infatuated. Couldn't get enough of it. You know, Christmas presents were the box set of the DVDs that came together. You know, we were going to see the movies on opening day, specifically the second Alien vs. Predator, which came out on Christmas Day, actually, that year. My dad and I went and saw it. And so the whole advent of that idea was when the trailer for Alien Covenant came out around Christmas of 2016. And I was jazzed. I was like, new Alien movie, first one since Alien vs. Predator. I guess Prometheus was kind of one, but it wasn't at the same time. I was like, man, I really kind of want to write my own sci-fi horror. And so knowing the, because I can't stand modern day horror because it's all just gratuitous gore and unearned jump scares, if you ask me, with the exception of a couple of really good more recent ones that have come out. But with that, knowing that that's the style that I like, I wanted to set out and write my own in my own universe. And so I based it off of, you know, again, a different group of friends, some who I was connected with through the internet, others who I had worked with in the hospital and was working with at the hospital at that point, who were also fellow veterans. And I just ran with it. And I was like, okay, what that, and that one was a very seat of the pants of like, okay, I want it to be an atmospheric old school sci-fi horror. So what does that mean? Well, the first third to almost half needs to be dedicated almost entirely to world and character building with little breadcrumbs of intrigue and almost horror, but more so, okay, where is this going to lead? What's that? What does that mean? X, Y, and Z until you get to the inciting event. And then it's just breakneck all the way through. And, you know, and while it's classified as horror, I almost think it's falls under the category of dread of that. Okay. Yeah. You're going through and things are happening, but it feels like you've got eyes on you. It feels like there's something breathing down the back of your neck, but you can't get away from it the whole time until things happen. And okay, now it's the big set piece, whether someone's getting killed or there's action or they're running and the stakes are very high all the way up until the very end. And then you may or may not get that breather. You got to figure out what it's going to be when you finally finish reading it. And so those were my main inspirations for writing that.
With everything that we've talked about tonight, with your military career, with writing, with all of those kind of things, I want your final thoughts on going from the military to being a contractor, to being a writer, to kind of maturing through all of those phases of your life. When people are at those beginning phases, what are your thoughts for them? people at the middle of those phases, what are your thoughts for them? And then people at the end, what are your thoughts for them? Because you've made a pretty seamless transition into your civilian life, as far as we know from what you write, what you say. Let's hear what you have to say for the beginning, the middle, and the end for those people that are going through it.
For the beginning, be a sponge. Sit back, shut up, unless you're going to ask a question that actually, you know, you don't know. Don't be afraid to know what you don't know, and then ask the people who do know, so that way you can learn and improve it. For the people in the middle, never settle. Always be thinking of what's next. What's the next step for me? What do I need to do to improve what I'm doing, be it personally, professionally, a hobby, you know, and even if it's just cursory research, because that can lead you down rabbit holes that'll cause you to approach things from a completely different angle that you wouldn't have thought of beforehand. And for people at the end, that's a tough one because I'm still figuring that one out myself. I would say definitely keep working to improve yourself, but also start to pivot to the more long-term, okay, now what am I going to do to lock myself in for that security, so that way I can finally take that step back and focus on myself and my family more than my career. That's what I would say. But with the caveat and a whole handful of salt of, I'm still getting there myself, so I'm not 100% sure.
Well, and I was going to ask you too, that kind of playing devil's advocate, you said the middle is always strive for that next part. Even when you reach the end, shouldn't you always be striving for something else? Maybe it's a very secondary thing that happens, but I feel like you should always have something to kind of look for, something to kind of strive for, because if you get stagnant, you don't really move around.
Oh, 100%. That's why I said that there should be that overlap with the middle, because once you reach the end, yeah, you might hang one life up, but who knows what could come from the next one. Maybe you can dedicate time to your hobby that you weren't able to before. Maybe you just want to pick up a new skill, bird watching, knitting, reloading ammo, whatever it is, because I'm a very firm believer in the saying, or when you stop learning is when you start dying. And yeah, so it's almost like how a shark needs to keep swimming to stay alive. Just keep pushing on, you know, there's always something to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Zach, these were amazing books that I've been through so far. You have a great story that you're out there. I'm so glad that we got to get together. Let's wrap this up by talking about where people can find you, where they can find these books, where they can get in touch with you if they have questions. I know every once in a while you've done a live on Instagram and stuff where people can ask you questions. But let's talk about the overarching social media, website, and where they can pick the books up.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main areas that people can find me are, so I do 99% of my stuff on Instagram. That's at author Zach James. I've still yet to crack the code on how to properly use Twitter, but that's also at author Zach James. Both of those Zach spelled Z-A-C-H, the proper way. And then for people who want to buy the books, they are available on Amazon and Audible. Amazon, you can buy Deception, Wet Work, and All in paperback, Kindle, and hardcover, along with audiobook. And Occupant is available in paperback, Kindle, and Audible. And for those who want to reach out to me, say hi, tell me my books suck, do that instead of leaving a bad review, please. You can reach out to me on any of those through direct messaging or authorzachjames@gmail.com. I had a website. I don't have a website now. Wix is giving me problems on getting that domain back. But once I do have that back, it'll be on my socials and you'll be able to find it.
Well, I'm so glad. And you should know that there are so many writers that have the name of Zach James. I don't know if you've looked into that, but it's mind-boggling how many of them there are. Zach, I want to thank you so much for opening up, telling us your stories, telling us about these books. They're a great thing, and I'm so glad that we got together to do this. Now, Everybody, you know where you can find Zach. Let's talk about where you can find me. As always, you can find me on Instagram at the DTD underscore podcast. You can find me on Facebook at the DTD podcast. You can find me on YouTube, where all these conversations are in video form. But your one-stop shop, it's DTDpodcast.net. That's audio, video. Zach's going to have his own page. It's going to have pictures of him. It's going to have his links to his books. It's going to have his bio. It's going to have his story. Everything that you could possibly want to know about Zach is going to be there. DTDpodcast.net. Now that we've talked about me, let's talk about the sponsors, the guys that make this show possible, Mack Belts and Police Coffee. Let's talk about Mack Belts first. Hand cut from veg tan, full grain saddle leather dyed to a classic saddle tan. It's contoured with black UV resistance parallel border stitch, handmade right here in the USA by veterans and designed by former Special Forces operator. Everybody knows that comes here. Mac Alexander's my buddy, retired Navy SEAL. He runs this company and he runs it fantastic, making the strongest belts, the baddest belts on earth. And when I say bad, I mean bad motherfuckers, because they are awesome. I don't go one day without wearing my Mac belt. I have two of them for nice and for just getting at it. It's perfect for any day carry, over the waistband, inside the waistband, everyday carry. It's the finest quality American craftsmanships that positively impact military charities. Make sure you go to MacBelts.com, check these guys out, and get yourself a Mack Belt, the toughest belts on earth. Now let's talk about coffee. Police Coffee is an officer-owned business, and they're dedicated to crafting the finest coffees and blends, and they're shipped to you as soon as they're made. Each batch, it's roasted fresh by people who know what it means to stay vigilant, and their coffee's some of the best you'll find. Let's talk about flavor. My favorite, One Ranger. The newest flavored coffee you're sure to love. One Ranger's flavorful, medium-bodied coffee with a smooth and sweet pecan flavor. Pecan coffee, it's probably the best combination in the world. It's rich, it's sweet, it's nutty and buttery, and its flavor cuts through coffee's natural acidity to give you a smooth and satisfying coffee experience. And when you go to policecoffee.com, DJK10 will get you 10% off your order. And when you go there, there's beans, there's ground, there's K-cups, there's dog treats. Anything that you possibly need to drink coffee or to make coffee is at their website. Don't forget them. They are who make this show happen. MacBelts.com, PoliceCoffee.com. Guys, that's going to be it for this week. Once again, Zach, it was great to have you in the studio. Make sure you guys catch us on the next one. We're out of here. See you later.